My fellow Americans, we have endured a week such as no nation should live through, a time of violence and tragedy.
I think the President of the United States played politics in a period of tragedy and riot.
We have made it very clear we do not want more than our share, but we are determined to settle for nothing less than our share.
I deplore the action of the UAW in forcing Ford into this situation. I am sorry that we do not have laws that effectively prevent the use of this kind of bludgeon against the public interest.
I understand our neighbors would wish to turn the clock back to 1947. The fact is, however, that most clocks move forward and not backward.
Hell no!
These are the sounds and voices of a year as WKNR News presents an electronic diary of 1967, a year marked by rioting, by a continuing war and growing protest, by a rise in crime and cost, and by tragedy and triumph. As with all years, there was good and bad. We shall recall both. A summer Sunday for most is one of the good things in life. It's a day for picnics, swimming, golf, a drive in the country, a day with friends and family. July 23rd was a Sunday. In Detroit, it was typical, hot and bright. The Detroit Tigers were only two games out of first place. At the stadium, they played a twin bill with the Yankees. 34,000 watched the games. It's doubtful any remember the day at the ballpark. July 23rd was the day the riot started. One week earlier, 25 persons had died when rioting hit Newark, New Jersey. The summer had seen trouble in some unlikely places: Albany, New York; Waterbury, Connecticut; Waukegan, Illinois; in Cincinnati, Dayton, Toledo, Ohio; in Louisville, Philadelphia, Poughkeepsie, and Phoenix. But after July 23rd, those outbreaks were nearly forgotten. The spark, as always, was a minor incident. It was routine police action, a raid on what Detroiters call a blind pig, an after-hours bar. In this case, on 12th Street, a sleazy strip of pawn shops and bars, a haven for pimps and prostitutes, junkies and gamblers. 85 persons were arrested in that raid. A crowd gathered to watch. There were some shouts, and then a rock through a police car window. The agony began. It was merely a matter of hours before the looting and arson had spread through the city. The first major fire came at 6:30, 3 hours after that routine police raid. A looted shoe store burned. It was the first of 2,000 fires. Along 12th Street, Negro shopkeepers hurriedly scrawled "Soul Brother" on store windows. The relief was temporary. Integrated mobs stole openly. The police stood by. They sealed off 12th Street, hoping to contain the rioting. It didn't work. All available firemen were called to duty. Trying to battle the burgeoning number of blazes became nearly an impossible task. Time after time, they were the targets of bricks and bottles at a fire scene. Later, those bricks and bottles became bullets.
Let's get under cover now, but move, let's go.
Where
did
that paper fire come from?
We don't know, but they just shot one at Holbrook. Stay under cover.
All uniformed men, stay under cover.
I heard the shot.
And like a plague, it spread, moving west and northwest across Woodward to the east side. It was out of control. At a command post downtown, city officials were joined by Michigan Governor Romney. State police were called in, the National Guard mobilized, and finally, federal troops requested.
As governor of the state of Michigan, I do hereby officially request the immediate deployment of federal troops into Michigan to assist state and local authorities in reestablishing law and order in the city of Detroit. I am joined in this request by Jerome P. Cavanaugh, mayor of the city of Detroit. There is reasonable doubt that we can suppress the existing looting, arson, and sniping without the assistance of federal troops. Time could be of the essence.
It would take 24 hours for those federal troops to get on the streets. There was first a debate over semantics. Should the governor request or recommend? Task Force Detroit was made up of the 101st and 82nd Airborne Divisions, combat veterans. They waited outside the city while Presidential Assistant Cyrus Vance viewed the burning city and vacillated.
The regular army troops are assembled in reserve positions at the fairgrounds, adjacent to the airport, and in the vicinity of the Detroit City Airport.
At midnight Monday, the president went on the networks.
Law enforcement is a local matter. It is the responsibility of local officials and the governors of the respective states. The federal government should not intervene except in the most extraordinary circumstances. The fact of the matter, however, is that law and order have broken down in Detroit, Michigan. Pillage, looting, murder, and arson have nothing to do with civil rights.
During his address, the president made it quite clear Michigan's governor had admitted a lack of control. He mentioned the governor 13 times, and Governor Romney replied,
I think the president of the United States played politics in a period of tragedy and riot. I don't think there's any question but that if we'd have had federal troops on the streets before dark Monday, that it would have had an effect.
But the troops did move in. They went to the city's east side. It was the second time in a quarter of a century that federal troops had been dispatched to quell a riot. Ironically, the other time was 1943 in Detroit. On the west side, the battle raged. The looting had dwindled. There was little left to loot. Middle-class Negro neighborhoods became havens for snipers. Patton tanks and other armored equipment rolled through city streets. Overhead, helicopters and reconnaissance planes flew swiftly through billowing clouds of acrid smoke. At one point, we crouched in the shadow of the General Motors building to record the sounds of a city at war.
Those shots are being fired on 12th Street. Two tanks have just moved into that area. Those first shots you heard were 50 caliber. The last apparently either from Detroit police, state police, perhaps National Guardsmen. This area full of snipers tonight. The vehicle sounds in the background are the tanks, armored personnel carriers. That would sound more like a sniper shot, the ones we've just heard. They're firing bullet bullets. Apparently moving more troops in. I'm looking up now, a truck of troopers coming in. This occurred just as we moved down from the 12th and Euclid area where we were in with the guard. Four casualties had to be moved out there. And that's the sound you're hearing all over Detroit this evening. In these areas that have been hit by earlier sniping, that one closer, 12th Street, which has been the scene since Sunday of the worst of the violence in Detroit, and where it flared anew again tonight.
At its peak, the riot spread over 14 square miles of the city. A curfew was in effect, a complete ban placed on liquor sales. Gasoline could be purchased only during certain hours and never in a container. Offices, banks, schools, businesses, industry were closed down. The heart of Detroit was deserted. Deliveries were curtailed. Food ran short. All normal activities in the nation's fifth largest city were at a standstill. By Thursday, it had run its course. Troops were told to sheathe their bayonets. On Friday, the last major fire was reported. And on Friday, the president again addressed the nation.
There is no American right to loot stores, or to burn buildings, or to fire rifles from the rooftops. That is crime, and crime must be dealt with forcefully
and swiftly, and certainly under law.
An 11-member commission was appointed to study the rioting, its causes and implications. It was the Kerner Commission. For Detroit, the Crimson statistics were totaled. 43 dead, untold thousands injured. No official figures could be kept. Nearly 2,000 fire runs, 7,231 arrests, and a dollar figure that totaled hundreds of millions. They had said it couldn't happen here, but it did, and left a bloody monument, the most devastating riot in the nation's history. And as it ended, Detroit's young mayor, Jerome Cavanaugh, viewed the ruins and looked to the future. He pointed to the city's motto, Resurgit Canaribus. It shall rise again from the ashes, and like the mythical phoenix, it would rise. The mayor appointed a 39-member committee. They called it New Detroit. He charged them.
We want today to build up this city from the ashes of the present conflict into the kind of urban environment in which every man and woman can say with dignity and self-respect that they're proud to be a Detroiter.
The makeup of the New Detroit Committee ran the gamut. Its chairman, 36-year-old Joseph L. Hudson, Jr., department store magnate. Members ranged from Henry Ford II and James Roach to leaders of the Negro community. New Detroit was successful in securing from Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler jobs for the underprivileged, and industry lessened standards to offer employment. The committee found tasks for young, and they strongly endorsed and fought for statewide open housing. To a special legislative session, the governor made an appeal.
In my opinion, it is absolutely essential to enable any American citizen to exercise the same rights as any other American citizen, and that applies in housing or any other field.
But open housing was not to be in 67. It did not pass and will be an issue in 68. In Detroit proper, an open housing ordinance came before the city's council. At a public hearing, there was strong support. Detroit's Archbishop, the Most Reverend John F. Dearden, said,
I ask you to pass this ordinance not because poor housing was judged to be one of the major underlying causes of last summer's revolt, nor from fear of more burning and violence, nor because it is politically expedient. I ask you to take this action because it is morally right.
And there was loud opposition, mostly from an ultra-right-wing group called Breakthrough, whose leader, Donald Lobsinger, assailed Negro council member Nicholas Hood.
Don't you like what I'm saying, Mr. Hood? Don't you like what I'm saying, Mr. Hood? Mr. Hood objects to my speaking any longer because Mr. Hood cannot stand the truth, you hypocrite.
Council approved the open housing ordinance, prohibiting discrimination in sale and rental and providing stiff penalties, said Councilman Hood.
Today we made history, whereas many people are making hysterical sounds. I think my colleagues joined with me in doing something very significant today.
As the year closed, however, a group of homeowners filed petitions containing 101,000 signatures to suspend the ordinance and put it on the ballot. The riot reverberations continued. Joseph L. Hudson said backlash could be a problem.
We've detected evidence of a backlash. Now, this is to be expected, but this must be minimized and met head-on if we're to wrestle with the conscience and arrive at some meaningful and legitimate solutions to the problems that this community faces.
A militant Negro leader, Reverend Albert Clegg, said the Negro wants control of the Negro community. Reverend Clegg was articulate in his explanation, but frightening in his implication.
Either there is a transference of power to the black community so that self-determination for the black community is possible, or black people have no alternative but to be violent and do anything else that's necessary, because any people have to have a power base upon which they operate.
Late in the summer, but not long after the rioting, H. Rapp Brown came to Detroit. His visit sparked fears, but only a comparative handful of Negroes chose to spend their Sunday listening to the Black Power firebrand. Brown wasted little time in his harangue.
You better quit running around here talking about loving these honkies to death. Do like they did during the American Revolution. They didn't love the British to death. They shot them to death. During rebellions, brother, you got to stop looting and start shooting.
Criticism continued in the wake of Detroit's outbreak. The charge, Trigger Happy, was leveled at the National Guard. Federal authorities instituted riot training. And time and again, the question was raised, why hadn't police acted faster when the 12th Street incident grew? Said Police Commissioner Ray Girardin.
We were at our lightest strength at the particular time this broke out, early Sunday morning, because usually the least is doing then, so we had the least men.
And the arch foe of the city's executives, Councilwoman Mary Beck, found new fuel in her daily battles with the mayor. The city's top man, said Miss Beck, was not where he should have been during July's rioting. During one council session, it went like this.
To suggest that by reading the penal code or the city charter that I belong physically at Herman Kiefer at 12th Street, I think is an exercise in the most ridiculous and ludicrous reasoning that I could possibly contemplate.
Then you have no regard for the penal code,
Mr. Well, oh, Miss Beck, I'm not even going to respond to some of your absurdities.
Long before July, Miss Beck began a recall campaign, accusing the mayor of any and all failures. She circulated petitions. By year's end, there had been no recall and few progress reports from the flowered hat at the council table. There were other riot repercussions. Three police officers were charged in connection with the killings of three Negro youths at a motel on July 26th. One faces murder charges. The story of the year was without question the days of madness in July. But it's a story with no end. Imaginative and liberal leadership had led Detroit, and yet it happened here. There are lessons to be learned. If they aren't, the summer of 67 may have a rerun in 68.
A teaspoonful of gospel is not enough. We must do all that is necessary until the freedom and independence of Vietnam has been assured.
Senator Everett Dirksen, a Republican, supporting administration Vietnam policy.
It should be clear by now that the bombing of the North cannot bring an end to the war in the South. And indeed, at the present time, it may well be prolonging that war.
Senator Robert Kennedy, a Democrat, opposing administration Vietnam policy. That dirty jungle war continued in the headlines through 1967, but in the year of turmoil, controversy over Vietnam reached new heights. Demonstrations became a way of life. They marched in protest everywhere. In October, a massive Washington demonstration was held. Many Detroiters went, among them a Wayne State University professor, David Hiroshoff.
We do not go to Washington, D.C. as insular American liberals, hoping to reason with our friend in the White House. We go to confront the chief enemies of the people of the world, the Yankee imperialists and their commander-in-chief, the vulture from Texas.
Others not so politically left just did not believe in the draft. One was Marvin Atlas, who turned in his draft card at Detroit's Selective Service Center and told WKNR,
first of all, I think the carrying of the card is a violation of my constitutional rights. And secondly, I think that the Vietnam War is unequivocally wrong, and I cannot cooperate with it in any way.
So as the war progressed, the dissent increased, and President Johnson viewed the dissenters.
And if I have done a good job of anything since I've been president, is to ensure that there are plenty of dissenters. And so what I would say is, let's realize that we're in the midst of a war. Let's realize that there are 500,000 of our boys out there that are giving their life to win that war. Let's ask ourselves what it is we can do to help. And if you think that you can make a contribution to helping them by expressing your opinion and dissenting, then do it.
One man who had taken more than his share from the protesters, Robert McNamara, threw in the towel. McNamara stepped down as Secretary of Defense to take the more serene post of President of the World Bank. In the war itself, more bombings and more battles. Strange names became a part of the average American's vocabulary. Doc Toe, Mekong Delta, Chu Lai, Dak San, and Hill 875. In December, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Earl Wheeler, addressed Detroit's Economic Club. Before WKNR microphones, General Wheeler assessed the war.
I am convinced of four things. One, we are winning the war in Vietnam. Two, I cannot predict when the war will end. Three, although the tide of battle is running against Hanoi, they are not yet convinced that they cannot win. And four, flowing from item three, Hanoi is not yet ready to negotiate an end to the war.
Late in the year, it was revealed that 15,000 Americans had died since we began participation. Another general, William Westmoreland, said the end was beginning to come in sight. There was another war in 1967. It lasted 6 days. The Mideast War saw Israel run rampant over Arab forces. To background the Mideast War would be to draw the chronology of centuries. Speaking at the United Nations, Israel's mellifluous foreign minister Abba Ibn noted,
I understand our neighbors would wish to turn the clock back to 1947. The fact is, however, that most clocks move forward and not backward. And this, I think, should be the case with the clock of Middle Eastern peace.
As 67 drew to a close, there was still no solution to the multiple problems that had led to that war in June.
When you recognize that people have misled you, you're much better prepared to prevent that from happening again. Nobody's going to brainwash me.
George Romney, Michigan governor and presidential candidate. During 1967, the governor had made many momentous decisions and several monumental bloopers. For most of the year, the governor continued his long, hard look, and in doing so, blurted out his now infamous brainwash statement, stating his thinking on Vietnam had changed because he'd been brainwashed on an earlier trip to Asia. It was fuel for his foes. But on November 18th, the governor said what everyone expected him to say.
I have decided to fight for and win the Republican nomination and election to the presidency of the United States. I've made my decision with great earnestness. I am concerned about America.
Shortly after, the governor left for a round-the-world trip, stopping at all major capitals, including Moscow, and visiting Vietnam. This time, he said, there was no brainwashing. On the Democratic side, the chairman of Michigan's Democrats, Zoltan Ferency, hit the political headlines with outspoken criticism of the president and a call for an open convention in Chicago.
There is a very serious risk, and you should all be aware of it, that by participating in this convention this morning, you will become outcasts in the minds of some people who hold power within the Democratic Party establishment.
Ferency finally quit his party post and told WKNR News,
well, as the titular leader, the wearer of that uncoveted ceremonial crown, I suspect that in the future I will be brought out on festive occasions like a object of art and displayed for all to see. But actually, in terms of statewide Democratic Party participation, it's going to be minimal.
Said Ferency he would support the efforts of Minnesota Senator Eugene McCarthy, who planned primary opposition to Lyndon Johnson. Was McCarthy's bid serious?
Well, I don't know whether it would be a serious effort to unseat him. It would certainly have to be interpreted as a serious action in opposition to the policies of the president.
But in Washington, where the real power remained, a reporter asked the obvious.
Are you going to run next year?
I'll cross that bridge when I get to it, as I've told you so many times, Mr. Randall.